Welcome to Startup Success, the podcast for startup founders and investors. Here, you'll find stories of success from others in the trenches as they work to scale some of the fastest growing startups in the world. Stories that will help you in your own journey. Startup Success starts now.
Welcome to Startup Success. Today, we have a very exciting guest host, Jeff Berkland, who is the CEO and founder of Berkland. So I am going to turn it over to Jeff, who has a special guest from the venture capital community with him today.
Oh, thank you, Kate. All right, we have with us my friend, Sid Trivedi. Sid's a partner at Foundation Capital. I can't wait to hear what we have to talk about, Sid. Sid, if we could, I'd love to hear first from you about how you became involved in investing in Foundation Capital.
Absolutely. And Jeff, I should say, I heard from Kate that this is your first time hosting the podcast, and I am so excited and honored that you're doing it with me. I'm eternally grateful.
I'll try not to say too much.
On that part, though, Jeff, just, you know, quick overview on my background. I was born in India, grew up in a bunch of different countries, Singapore, India, Indonesia. We moved a lot. And the main reason for that was my dad was very early at Nokia, which most people don't know today, but was a very famous mobile phone company. And when my dad joined Nokia in the 90s, the concept of a mobile phone didn't exist. So as a kid, I got to see this platform shift from desktop to mobile, and that happened all in my home. Like, it wasn't on the news or on TV or something. It was happening in my home. I mean, we had every single model of every single mobile phone, and that Nokia launched from the late 90s all the way into the 2000s. And, you know, my dad was certainly the it person at every party. But it was very, very exciting to kind of see that shift, and that got me very excited about technology. And, you know, my mom was an investment banker. So she had this finance background, and it was interesting. And you know, through it all, I thought, well, you know, this tech, you know, field seems really interesting. And finance also seems very, very intriguing. And I wonder if there's an opportunity to combine the two. So I moved to the U.S. first to study at Cornell. And while there, I, you know, started to hear a little bit about venture. And I never thought that I would join the industry. But I thought maybe, you know, when I'm successful and I'm a very successful founder, something like this will happen. I got to join it, though, through a pretty unique path. I first worked in investment banking, and I worked at Barclays, which was going through a transition from Lehman Brothers to Barclays as a result of the 08 crisis. And then subsequently moved into private equity and then moved into early stage venture capital. But through it all, I focused very specifically on IT and cybersecurity. And that obviously has been a category over the past decade, which has really grown. So it's been a lot of fun to kind of cover a sector that has gone from its infancy to being one of the most defining categories within enterprise software today.
That's awesome. I just have to comment on one of the things you said. I didn't realize how old I was until you told me that some people don't know Nokia anymore. What do you mean?
When I tell people, most people have no idea what Nokia is. Like, many times, like, you have to explain to them. And then I think the other interesting thing, and given we're talking about startups, is most people don't realize how innovative Nokia was. I mean, it was a steel company, a rubber company. It did mobile phones. Today it does telecom. I mean, that company has consistently innovated over 100 years. It's been very interesting to see.
That's awesome. Well, speaking of innovation, so you see a bunch of it. You've got to have a lot of great stories about some innovation you've seen, perhaps a investing story that you've seen that relates to some fantastic innovation. Anything you can share with us?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many interesting stories. Maybe I'll do some funny stories. I think the funniest story for me in this business is just how competitive this business is. There are so many smart people in venture, and however good you might be in understanding a category or understanding why an investment opportunity is unique, there will likely be other people who have that same affinity. And I remember one of the early investments I made, 6 or 7 years ago now, in Ativo Networks. I remember trying to convince Tushar Kotari, the CEO, to take our capital. And Tushar was trying to decide between, and this was at my prior firm, which was smaller than Foundation, but you know, he was deciding between a very large multi-billion-dollar venture firm, my prior firm. And like, I remember having a conversation with Tushar. So we gave him a term sheet in the middle of December. And
right.
You know, he said, hey, I need some time to think about it. And I said, okay. And my assumption was it'll take about a week. I'd done this process before. But Tushar is a very, very successful operator. He was early at Cisco, very, very early at Cisco, and one of the earliest executives. And he took about 25 days to sign a term sheet. And I remember talking to him every single day in December into the first week of January. And I was traveling in Asia.
You were sweating it out, too.
It was every day. It was every day, Jeff. It was Christmas. It was Christmas Eve. It was New Year's. It was New Year's Day. And the only reason I know this was I remember seeing the phone bill, which obviously the firm was paying, but I remember seeing this phone bill and looking at all the calls and thinking, oh, my goodness, this
better pay off.
Really large bill. But it's amazing just how competitive this business is. And the most successful founders are spending a lot of time trying to make a decision on who is the best investor. And you know, I give full credit to Tushar for making that decision.
Yeah. I have to admit, when I came out of business school, I thought VC sounded like a fun thing to do. And you know, you romanticize it and you see all these great successful VCs and you think it's pretty easy. You know, I feel embarrassed to say that. And now being around a lot of VCs in the role that I have, I realize it's not for me. And I have a lot of respect for what you do. It is a hard job. It's got to be a right fit, but that's cool. Good story. You said you had a few. I want to hear another.
Yeah. You know, the other one that I was going to mention, and we can talk more about this because I know that Birkeland is a CFO partner with this company, is Stacklit, which is, you know, one of my more recent investments. It was made in summer of last year. And you know, it was the first investment that we as a firm here at Foundation Capital did without ever meeting the founders in person. Mm. Nobody on our team had met a single member. Back then, when I say a single member, it was just two founders, a pitch deck, no product at Stacklit. So it was very, very early. There was no website. There was nothing. But we had made investments before where we'd met a founder. One of us had met a founder, but not the full partnership. We'd made investments where another person who wasn't the investor lead had met the founder, but we'd never actually made an investment where no one had met the founders. And this was in the height of the pandemic. It was in May of last year, in 2020. And I think the toughest part for us as a firm was trying to figure out, you know, can we do these types of things? And we as a firm get involved very, very early. In the venture business. So we're typically there as at your first or second round of funding. And I define that for founders as, you know, we get involved when there's somewhere between 1 to 30 people on the team at our point of, you know, initial investment. And we typically lead the round and we typically join the board. So once we write an investment, we are all in and we're in for the long term. And in this case, it was complex to kind of be all in because you're making a decision on a market, which I understood very well, which was in cloud security. But the second thing you're making a decision is on two founders. And without being able to meet them, how do you make that decision? The way that I did it from the time that I met the founders to the time that I gave them a term sheet, which was roughly 3 weeks, I spoke to them every single day, you know, on the weekends as well. And that was more than I would normally. You know, if we were meeting them in person, it would be a different experience. But I got to really know them through each of those days. You know, we did more formal discussions, we did more informal discussions. And then on top of that, I've always done founder references before making an investment. But in this case, I spoke to every single person that Travis and Kapil, the two co-founders, had worked for in their prior roles.
Wow.
And I went back to like their first, Travis's first job out of college, which is a while ago, and just hearing what people said about these two individuals. And it really helped. And I'd say if I look at it today, fast forward today, and we're almost exactly one year in to that experience of investing, most of the things I got right. There were some things which I didn't expect, and overwhelmingly positive. You know, I had questions about the two founders, but overwhelmingly it has been a positive perspective. I was more worried, but it ended up being less of a worry than anything.
You know, there are a couple things in what you talked about that I'm curious about. When you did this deep reference checking, so did you scare up some ugly stuff? Like, did you scare up some things where, like, these are a few things they need to work on? My feeling is there's always something people need to work on, right? And if I don't hear that in a reference check, I actually get concerned. But I'm curious sort of how you live with, you know, trying to scare up weaknesses and how you evaluate weaknesses when you're doing that.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I would have answered it the same way, which is that if there aren't areas for improvement or weaknesses that are highlighted, then I'm not doing my job in terms of getting the right references. If I'm mm-hmm. only hearing overwhelmingly positive information, then that's an issue. And I am digging to try to figure out where the weaknesses are. Not because, you know, I'm trying to find flaws in every person, but it's important to understand and have an eyes wide open approach to thinking about where the issues might lie. And, you know, if I look at companies where things have not gone well for us, both me personally as well as the firm, it's been because we didn't identify an area of improvement or a weakness and didn't factor that in to the company building process.
What do you find you do with those weaknesses? Like, when you learn about them, you know, I see a spectrum. One is, you know, there's a category where you're like, that's fine, I can live with that weakness, you know, that's versus others that maybe you can't live with. And then another potential is, well, that's a weakness. Now that I know about it, I can work on it, right? And we can surround them.
In most situations, you're trying to figure out, well, how do I solve for that weakness? And that weakness can be as simple as person, founder X is fantastic at sales, but doesn't have technical product knowledge. He or she may not be able to figure out how to build product. And because they're so overly promotional, sometimes mm-hmm. they will be selling right. you a vision without thinking about whether that vision can actually be applied. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a major issue. Now, that can be solved if you have a co-founder, you know, person Y, who is more technical and is thinking about how to build product consistently. That's a good example. And if there isn't a person Y, then, you know, we start to think about, well, who should we insert as a person Y? And not only can that person Y be, should that person Y be technical and able to build products, but they should be able to speak up to person X. Person X should respect, you know, his or her decisions and thoughts. Otherwise, you know, you will be selling an overly promotional vision well in advance of any, you know, real product. That's a great example of a situation. There are very few instances where founders are not strongly opinionated. So, you know, hearing that feedback, I mean, I hear it all the time.
It's almost one that if you don't hear it, you're like, I wonder what.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, we want founders to be opinionated. If they're not opinionated, then that's a major issue, because most of the time they're trying something that's completely different to what the industry thinks is normal, or what customers think is normal, or what the current market thinks is normal, or what other investors think is normal. So we want founders to be opinionated and have a vision and continue to push on that vision. Now, we want them to also consider other perspectives. We want somebody who is able to look at and evaluate whether that vision is working and how they may need to bend or change that vision. But ultimately, we don't want them to kind of bend at the first kind of negative comment. We want them sure. to have a point of view.
Yeah. That makes sense. The other thing you said in your story was you never met them in person, right?
Yeah.
So you're talking to them every day, and some of it's formal, some of it's informal. I can get a pretty good picture on the formal. I'm curious about the informal. Like, how did you go about thinking about that? And replicating that online is kind of hard, right? You might, for example, if it's in person, you might meet up for drinks or a ball game or something like that. That's a tough one.
It is really, really hard. And I wish I had a good answer. I don't think we do. And this is why I believe that at least our industry in venture capital will be one of the first industries to go back to work in a physical office. I mean, this is an early stage venture capital. This experience is really important. But the way that I did it was trying to understand both the founders, Travis and Kapil's, backgrounds. know, what had they done in prior lives? What were their families like? What were they interested in outside of cloud security? Mm-hmm. With the little time that they had, where were they spending time? And you know, there were very interesting things. Like Travis, the co-founder and CEO, had worked with Kapil at Capital One in the DC region, but Travis had always kind of lived outside of the physical offices that he worked in. So the region where the physical offices are, and Travis had been in Kentucky, you know, for most of his life. And the main reason for that is his wife is a competitive dressage athlete, and they live in a horse farm, which is pretty amazing to kind of hear. But it was just understanding those types of stories. You had this founder who was building this innovative cloud security company and had worked in a bunch of different technology companies and startups before that, but lived in Kentucky and, you know, had a wife who was a competitive athlete focused on horses. Like, it's not something you would expect. And I will tell you that the awesome thing about, I know I'm going on a little bit of a tangent, but Jeff, the awesome thing about virtual meetings and making these decisions virtually is you get to find founders like that, you know, who are not your typical Bay Area founder who worked at a fantastic technology company here in the region and is now starting their fourth, fifth, sixth startup. But it was really understanding Travis and Kapil's stories and what got them excited outside of just work. And I think a lot of that is just time. I wish that there was an answer in terms of like a cool game that we played, or we tried to do a virtual dinner, or I've heard, you know, other investors doing that. I don't think those work as well, to be honest. At least for me, they haven't. But understanding people's backgrounds does really, really help. You get to understand what motivates them.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably, if you weren't already doing it, my guess is maybe you were, but there's perhaps something to bring back to the physical world, gaining that depth of understanding of the person.
Absolutely. And I should mention, so I did finally get to meet both founders last year. I made a trip to Washington, D.C. in September of last year, right when the you know, COVID cases out here in the Bay Area region were low, as well as the COVID cases in the D.C. region were low. It was also the first and only trip that the firm made formally. So I was the only person from the firm who flew on an airplane for a work-related meeting during a global pandemic without vaccines at the time. But it was awesome to meet the two founders. And I think the most surprising thing, by then we had been, you know, we'd been investors for a couple of months, but the most surprising thing was realizing that Travis was taller than I expected. Kapil was shorter than I expected. Like, it's very hard to make that assumption that, you know, you can't really ask people what their height is, or It's not a good conversation starter.
Yes, I hear that a lot. And it's a really fun one with your kid. So my 10-year-old, right. You know, I didn't realize my teacher was so tall. awesome. Yeah, so you were saying you think, you know, venture capital will be one of the first ones to come back in person. And, you know, that could lead us down a really interesting path. You know, one brief aside, I was talking with another venture capitalist and he said he won a deal at some point in the past. I don't know if it was a couple months back or many months back, but during the pandemic, because he visited the entrepreneur and nobody else did. And that made the difference. And so I think, you know, there's definitely something to in person. You know, a lot of people are saying that. On the flip side, you hear a lot of talk about all remote companies, you know, the next largest startup ecosystem outside of the Bay Area is going to be remote. That's something I read recently, and I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
It's interesting that you mentioned that other venture capitalist. The funny thing is, I made two investments this year in 2021. The first one I made earlier this year in February. I believe we won it also because we met the founders in person. So the advantage here was the founders were based in the Bay Area. They were not on the East Coast. So it was easier to meet them. But there were two big things that made that a huge advantage. You know, I'd done a bunch of reference calls, very similar to Stacklit, the earlier company I mentioned, on both the founders. Again, it was very similar story. Two founders, pitch deck, no product, no website. So very early days. And I was doing founder reference calls, talking to the founders every single day for the first 10 days. But meeting both of them Harish and Bucci in person had a dramatic impact in helping me to figure out, A, what made the two of them tick. And I had questions with both of them around what their place in the company was. Why had they picked one to be the CEO versus the other, for example, was one question. Mm-hmm. And it became very obvious when you met them in person. And I talked to them after we gave them the term sheet and convinced them to sign it. But we were the first firm to meet them in person. There were two other firms that did do it. But they got to see the experience that we had, all of us connecting. Mm-hmm. And that had a pretty big impact on their decision to choose us, to choose Foundation. So I think the in-person factor is definitely there, particularly if the companies are based here in the Bay Area, where increasingly VCs are more open to meeting founders before they make a decision. But at the same time, I see the benefits of having this remote perspective. We, as a firm pre-COVID, about 60% of our portfolio was based here in the Bay Area. And we haven't yet run the numbers, but I'm pretty sure that number, I can tell you just by the number of investments we did over the past 12 months, we have started to do significantly more investments outside of the Bay Area than prior years. And I think part of that is the remote perspective.
That's interesting. Now, how does that translate, in your opinion, into companies themselves? Do you have a perspective on the approach companies, and you'll probably be thinking of some pretty early companies given when you invest, but where do you fall on that? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think companies are all trying to make decisions, and I have companies that are as small as the most recent one I mentioned, Levo, which is just six people right now, two when I invested, all the way up to a couple hundred people. And that's these are direct companies that I manage. And then as a firm, we have companies that are in the early thousand number of people and that are still in our portfolio. And I think every CEO is trying to make a decision. And the few things that they're trying to consider that I've heard as considerations, one, there is this question around how do you build culture in a remote environment? And that's really around, how do you build loyalty? How do you build a sense of community to retain talent in an increasingly competitive technology market where that talent can go and work at a different company? So when things are going well, it's easy to retain talent. But when things are going badly, and almost always they will go badly in a startup, there are going to be bad days. How do we keep the employees motivated in staying at that company and believing in that company? And there's an inherent value in coming into a physical office and seeing your colleagues versus being on Zoom or some other platform and being one box out of many in terms of creating that culture and that brand and that sense of belonging. So how do you kind of do that? And my hope is, and what I've seen be successful pre the pandemic, has been having monthly or quarterly in-person gatherings for the entire team. And I hope that for the companies that do decide to stay fully distributed, they will do those events in person and use budget that would have been allocated for office spend to actually hold in-person events, some exotic location maybe, or some place that's exciting, and bring the company together. The second thing is just the processes are very different. The things around task management, obviously having video on during calls, Slack, email, how do you host happy hours or the equivalent of a water cooler chat during the day that are necessary. And I think tools and processes are really important in a remote first work environment. And on that topic, I would say the third thing is, how do you figure out syncing between team members? So usually you need more syncs when you're virtual, primarily because the walking up to an individual is very tough to do.
I missed a little bit, Sid, but I did hear something about a water cooler, replicating some of the water cooler chat. And I'm curious about that. What are you seeing? Like, how do you do that?
It's hard. I think you do it. To me today, the virtual water cooler chats seem more like Band-Aids rather than a long-term fix. But the way that it's being done right now is through having a set. So there's a few things. One, a certain set of companies will host smaller town halls, whether that's on a daily or a weekly basis. I've had some of my companies host it on a daily basis. So every day at lunchtime, which is hard to do in a distributed environment because your equivalent of lunchtime might be different depending on where you are. But every day at lunchtime, they will have a one-hour block that is kind of the whole team comes together onto a Zoom call or onto whatever platform they're using to just chat about what's going on, things that might be important. The second thing is holding more syncs, like formal syncs.
I might need to take that into my business.
Holding more formal syncs, one-on-ones, a smaller team group on a weekly, bi-weekly, sometimes daily, depending on the situation, but at minimum monthly basis, so that you have a good sense from every single person at the company and, you know, what their issues are and what they're excited about. And then I think the third is there are new virtual platforms that are coming out. So there are platforms like Gather and Sophia. And the best way to describe them, Jeff, is it's almost like Sims. It's like the old Sims, video game. But so you have these virtual avatars that walk around. But then when you get close to somebody, you get on video and you're able to kind of have conversations on video. There are certainly products like that have existed that are trying to kind of emulate the office. And with these platforms, with Gather and Sophia, the companies that have been testing them have actually asked those vendors to go and create their physical office in the virtual world. So, you know, have a physical water cooler that you could go to the kitchen, just the way that it looks like in the office, all the floors, the way they look like, to make it feel like you're in the office so that you can almost imagine as if you were doing something that you were doing in 2019.
What I'd love to do maybe now is kind of turn to the ecosystem. And what I have in mind is, you know, what do you think has historically made the Bay Area ecosystem so strong for startups? And then what do you see for post-pandemic, whether that's Bay Area, that's interesting, but also outside the Bay Area, whether that's remote or what, you know, how those ecosystems are going to evolve or anything like that that you may be seeing?
Yeah. I think what's made the Bay Area so successful is the concept that failing in your job or failing in your job in that you join a startup and it fails, failing in your startup, as in you start a company and it fails, is very acceptable. It is not considered odd or abnormal to see this failure and have that failure happen again and again. And because people are not afraid to fail, they end up coming up with crazy ideas that usually are very different to the norm, which end up, a subset of them end up being very, very successful. And I think every other community has been trying to replicate that concept of being okay with the social faux pas of failing. And the second thing I think, so in my opinion, that is the most important part that has allowed the Bay Area to be so, so successful. The second part I think that has allowed it to be successful is because it's okay to fail, because more and more founders have been created who've created those successful companies by failing multiple times. There are a lot of very creative people who live here. And when you have so many creative minds so close together in a region, you end up having the multiplying effect of those creative minds coming together to try even more interesting ideas. And obviously, you know, we as venture capitalists and broadly service providers to the community, and Jeff, you're very much in that bucket of providing financial services, CFO services. We obviously help to kind of foster that ecosystem, but we are I'm very certain that we are only beneficiaries of it. You know, our level of help is limited versus the founders. I think the question now is, does the Bay Area continue to keep its competitive advantage post the pandemic? Because what the pandemic has shown is that you can access the Bay Area's talent virtually. And if you can access it virtually and you don't have to pay the the high real estate prices or the high taxes, then why not be somewhere else? And so we are, you know, I think we're at this critical juncture where founders will need to decide, is it really, really essential to be here in the Bay Area? Or is it more important to be in a community or a part of the country or a part of the world where the cost of living is more normal for all of your employees? And that, I think, is a big question.
That's fascinating. You're a smart cookie, Sid. I have to think about this one. That, like, what would I find important if I were in that dilemma right now? I mean, I feel like I don't know if you can replicate the risk-takingness remotely and elsewhere. You know, I almost think you have to be around that group. However, like you said, you know, where do you want your employees to be? What if it's so expensive here? Do you have to keep that? You know, is there a happy middle? That's a fascinating perspective.
I can try to answer it. And my hunch, this is just my opinion. I think different people have different opinions here. My hunch is that the Bay Area will continue to be the mecca for startups and for creation of new companies. And I believe that because if you are an early stage founder, there is a distinct value of being here. And that value is because most of the capital today is still based out here. And that some of that capital is moving. There's some well-known firms that have moved to other parts of the country. But predominantly that capital is staying here. So there's value for being here. Again, the same applies for most of the large technology companies. There are some that have decided to move into other areas, but most of them have stayed on out here. So there's value of having talent that's based here. And then the last one I would say is the founders who have been successful in past, you know, years and decades are still based here. And when I talk to founders who have had overwhelming success, and I've spoken to a number of them over the past year, whether their company has gone public or it's had a very, very successful acquisition, most of them are still planning to stay here in the Bay Area. Very few of them tell me, you know what, Sid, taxes are very high or the cost of living has gone up and I've made a decision to move to another region. I think, you know, they are in this fortunate position in life where they've got enough personal money and they've made the decision that they want to be here in the Bay Area. So if you want to access those people, they're obviously predominantly going to be based here.
Cool. I appreciate you sharing that. That resonates. So as we sort of start to wrap up here, let's see, a couple areas. Just any advice you have for founders today? We've talked about a lot now, right? But any sort of parting shots for founders today?
I think the biggest thing I would tell founders right now is capital is very, very inexpensive. Like we're all seeing that this year. And it's, you know, we can talk about why it's inexpensive, but high level interest rates are low. Global governments are continuing to pour money into their economies to pump up the economy. And as a result of that, consumer demand is high. Consumer demand impacts enterprise demand. Mm-hmm. So capital is cheap. People are trying to find, investors are trying to find ways to generate alpha, to generate returns. And venture capital is a very interesting asset class to try to do that in. And so most of us in the venture business have a lot of capital to deploy. And there are new entrants who are coming in all the time. There are new hedge funds, there are new corporate venture arms, there are new venture funds being created. So capital is cheap. And if you are a founder who has come up with a decent idea with an interesting background, the likelihood that you'll be able to raise capital is quite high right now. And it's as high as it can ever be. And so the big question that you have to try to determine as a founder is, you know, what additional value does that investor bring outside of the capital? And are they the best investor based on the weaknesses and issues that I have as a founder to bring on board to the team? And I tell founders all the time to think of your investors, particularly your early stage investors, your first or your second investor, as effectively a co-founder. And, you know, for better parts, we are one. When we invest in Foundation, we're taking between 20 to 25% ownership for our investment. So you many times we think of ourselves as a second or third or fourth co-founder. And it is very, very important for us that our founders feel that we are bringing something else to the table outside of the capital that we bring in. And whether that is access to customers in the early days, helping you think through who your first 10 customers will be, hiring key executives. And key executives could be a senior manager, but it could also be, you know, a very, very unique engineer that you're looking to hire. Thinking about strategy and thinking about what makes, you know, your company successful versus the market and how you may need to navigate the market with new entrants as well as incumbents trying out new things. And then lastly, thinking about multiple rounds of fundraising that you will have to, usually you will have to raise over many, many years. All those four facets are things we think about. And, you know, each of us have certain skills in one of those areas. But I always tell founders to really, really consider, well, what else is the investor bringing outside of the money that they're providing?
For what it's worth, that's something we see as well. In the startups, we help the value of a good investor fit and a good investor is huge. So I would double down on what you said, Sid.
Absolutely.
Let's see. I'm going to talk about how we met each other, but before I do that, anything you want to point out about yourself, Foundation Capital, something you want to, you know, leave in our listeners' minds?
Yeah, you know, I think if I could be selfish and provide a quick promotion for us, you know, we do just early stage venture investing. We are typically your first or your second investor into a company. And we have consciously made the decision to focus just on that. You know, there's an opportunity to do lots of different things in venture. You can do late stage, you could invest in founder equity, you could get, you know, we have venture firms who are now creating SPACs. We don't do any of those things. We just do early stage, and we make that conscious decision because we think it's really important that if you want to be good at something, that you focus very, very specifically on that. And not only do we focus on that early stage, but we are also very sector focused. So there are 10 of us here at the firm, and we focus on four big sectors: enterprise software, consumer, fintech, and what we call frontier tech. And on the enterprise side, even further on, you know, we are, each of us who focus on the enterprise software investments front also focus on subcategories. And I mentioned that I focus on IT and cybersecurity investing, and that's an area I've now focused on for the last decade. But the advantage that that gives me is a network that can help founders have a differentiated and unfair advantage in gaining access to their first few customers in particular. And that in cyber and IT, I believe, is a differentiating factor. And that network of, you know, customers that I know now is well over 180 CIOs, CISOs, and CTOs of principally global 2000 companies. And these are companies like PayPal and Equifax and FICO and Intuit. And I use those executives to help me help my founders go and find their first few customers. And also, of course, help me to diligence companies and help me to think about new opportunities for investing. But more importantly, I'm razor focused on helping my founders find their first few customers in an area, cybersecurity and IT, where there are a lot of new startups being created and there's a ton of incumbents. And I think it's that razor focus, early stage, sector focus, and even within sector, subsector focus that gives us a unique viewpoint in how we think about investing in venture.
Yeah, Sid, you and Foundation are top notch for those early companies. So hopefully you keep finding good ones and they keep coming to you because it's great for them.
Thank you for the kind words.
Only same because I mean them. So Sid, I forget how long ago it was we met. When we met, we were introduced. We were meeting on the street somewhere. I forget, outside of some. My memory is some coffee shop that we met, and I remember that you suggested that we walk over to this bubble tea place, Boba Tea, I'm familiar with that. It's a popular thing in Toronto when I go visit. So we grabbed some and then we stepped outside and walked along the Embarcadero. I was ready to sit down, typical as you sit down at a coffee shop and have a talk conversation. But instead we went and at least an hour, I think, right? Walking along the Embarcadero and
Easily.
back. It was refreshing, I have to say, as opposed to sitting down. So number one, I look forward to doing that again with you, when we start getting back. And number two, I hope these sort of walk and talks, I think more and more people do them. I hope they continue.
I couldn't agree more. And it's funny, Jeff. I actually, because you'd sent me the questions in advance, I took a look at this question and I was trying to remember late last night, very late last night, when exactly did we meet? And I poured through my emails and got the full details. So I will add more to your story. You're absolutely right. We met at Steep Creamery, right inside Splunk headquarters in San Francisco. That was our first kind of walk and talk meeting. But funnily enough, we met a little bit before that. If you'll remember this, the two of us were at a Giants game. We had both been invited by another bank, and you kind of came up to me halfway through it, and you said, "Hey, I work on helping startups manage their financial services needs, their CFO needs, and I'd love to find some time to catch up." And I said, absolutely, we should definitely do it. We have lots of startups and we should have a conversation. And I also did check, Jeff, it was about 5 years ago now. So it took me some time to remember this whole story. But I do remember the long walk we took. And I remember you saying, hey, this is refreshing. This is different to what we normally do sitting in a conference room. And I think, it's been a fantastic journey. You've been a fantastic partner over the years. You've worked with a number of my startups, Stacklet being just the most recent one, but there's so many. And I also distinctly remember when you put your hand up and agreed to join me as a co-host and speak in front of all of our enterprise CFOs and CEOs at an event that I'd done to help them to think about financial metrics back in 2019. And it was just, I remember getting feedback from a number of different founders after that event saying, I would like to work with Birkeland Associates because of Jeff Birkeland. The points that he just made are the things that I care about. Like, for the first time, I had somebody who could explain to me financial concepts in a simple manner and help me to think about things like take a very close look at how much your cash allotment is and how much you are burning on a monthly basis.
That's awesome, Sid. Thank you. Yes, it's been a great journey these past 5 years, as you said. Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's crazy.
Thanks for joining this podcast, Sid.
Absolutely.
This
Thank you
was
for having me.
great. Kate, anything you want to?
No, thank you both. What a fascinating conversation. It was a real treat to listen to.
You've been listening to Startup Success. To make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. Like what you hear? Tap the number of stars you think the show deserves in Apple Podcasts. For more tools and resources for your own startup success, check out BirklandAssociates.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.